Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Porrig O'Malley has devoted much of his life to making peace, bringing adversaries together to resolve some of the world's most intractable conflicts, from Northern Ireland to South Africa to Iraq. O'Malley is an Irishman, author and professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and when he's not traveling, he lives in Cambridge, where he owns the Plough and Stars pub, which helps finance his global peacemaking efforts. It's a bit ironic, perhaps, because O'Malley is an alcoholic. He's been sober for the past 14 years, but he says being an addict, attending regular AA meetings, inspired his approach to conflict resolution.
The people in conflicts like Northern Ireland or in Israel and Palestine had the characteristics of addicts. And I developed a very simple theory that just as AA works on the principle that one alcoholic is in the best position to help another, that one divided society is in the best position to help another.
Now that cut comes from a new documentary by Central Square Films and Brookline-based director James Demo. It dives deep into the professional and personal life of Porrig O'Malley. It's called The Peacemaker. It screened recently at the Independent Film Festival in Boston and will premiere in Europe next month in the UK. And Porrig O'Malley joins us. Welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony.
So let's start with this idea that is central to the work you do, that people from divided societies are in the best position to help other people from divided societies. Why does that approach work?
Every alcoholic or addict thinks he or she is unique. And it's only when they come into a program like AA or Narcotics Anonymous or other such programs and they hear the stories of others that they realize that while details may vary, their stories are essentially the same. And that I could look across at you and say, Anthony, those words could be coming out of my mouth. That's exactly what I think or have been thinking.
I want to ask you about the work that you do, and the documentary talks about this. And this goes back to 1997. You brought people from both sides of the sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland to South Africa to meet Nelson Mandela. A year later, the Good Friday Accords were signed, creating a power-sharing agreement. So what happened there in South Africa?
This took about three or four years to set up, because while the South Africans were more than willing to receive the Northern Irish, two of the major parties in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin or IRA and Ian Paisley's party, the hardline Democratic Unionist Party, were simply not talking to each other. And even when Mandela came to this conference, they would not sit in the same room as Sinn Féin. I had to go to Mandela and say, Madiba, would you mind a little apartheid here? You have to do everything twice. And he laughed.
He was familiar with that concept.
Yeah. And in fact, it worked out even better because he was able to give a targeted message to each audience individually. But people in conflicts get stuck in their approaches or they come across obstacles that they can't cross, or they can't compromise on, or they don't know how to compromise on.
Is the fundamental idea here that if we can do it, if we could make this work in South Africa, figure out a way to come together, then you can too?
Yes. It's a matter of finding a way of making compromises you have sworn you will never make.
Yeah. I would love to ask you about your role in this, because at one point in the documentary, you are described, the term ideologically neutered is used, the idea that you can stand in the middle and bring people together to earn their trust.
Well, I don't simply have any fixed set of political beliefs. I feel equally at home talking to members of the IRA or talking to members of Hamas or any group like that as I would be with an archbishop or a cardinal. They're just people, and they have different stories to tell and different narratives and different views. So I don't attach a label to somebody who, like, say, is in Hamas and say he's a terrorist. I don't attach a label to somebody who's in Hezbollah and say he's a terrorist, because the label is useless. It tells you nothing. In fact, by labeling somebody in that way, you're essentially demeaning the person and saying targeting this person for assassination is no big deal because they're an evil person. when we turn the world into good guys and bad guys, and that we're the good guys, and all these guys out there in ISIS roaming around Europe are the bad guys, and the quicker we kill them, the better. All we're doing is creating conditions to augment the problem, not to deal with it. We have to find the roots of the problem. And in the case of extremist, radical extremist organization in Islam, we have not sufficiently done that yet, because most of the work done on this explaining to us what extreme radicalism is about has been done by Westerners with it's their core of values. So
I understand that, but it does seem like we have a problem. And you mentioned ISIS. I mean, when ISIS is engaging in these kinds of horrific acts that we're reading about and seeing, how do you sort of get around that and sort of put aside the label of terrorist or executioner or beheader or something like that?
That's a good question. West Belfast, where the IRA had its strongholds, is you know, generational unemployment. No one works. Kids don't work. You know, kids would be hanging on a street corner, drinking beer, smoking cigarettes, looking at the girls. Somebody comes along, taps somebody on the shoulder and says, hey, would you like to do something really important? Kid says, yeah, sure. He's taken away. He's trained by the IRA. And 6 months later, he's walking down the streets of Belfast and his chest is out and he's saying, I am somebody. You know, I have a cause bigger than myself. I'm going to be a liberator of my country. And besides that, I can kill. And the feeling that I can kill is a powerful feeling. Early next year, we are bringing together young marginal Muslims from the key cities in Europe to work out, for them to work out together, how to give value and meaning to their life, so that they can say, I am somebody. There's 300 million youth living at the bottom of the pit, and they will never work. And when we tell them that, don't worry, your government is going to find jobs for you in education, we're essentially telling them lies all the time.
And so that essentially creates a fertile climate in which an organization like ISIS could grab hold of them.
The most important thing for a human being is to think that he or she, that her life or his life has meaning. Without meaning, the alternative, the existential alternative, is despair. And finding meaning, and organizations like ISIS, with their fantastic propagandistic approach and their way they use the internet and other tools of social media, know how to tap into that sense of lack of meaning and pull out individuals and say, we can give your life meaning.
I want to ask you a little bit about what drives you, Padraig O'Malley. And I want to play another piece of tape from the documentary, The Peacemaker. And we're going to hear from Nancy Reardon, who works with you, and John Alderice, a Northern Ireland political leader, talking about you. Let's listen to this clip.
He will sacrifice his own health, certainly his own economic well-being, for the cause that he has adopted. I don't know why this personal commitment is so intense.
Do you think Padraig is working for peace to be rich? Do you think he's doing it to be famous? Maybe he made a promise. Some people make promises. If you let me live, this is what I'm going to do. Maybe it's that big. I don't know. But there is something about him I can't put my finger on. If you figure it out, let me know.
If you figure it out, let me know. People seem almost perplexed by this personal commitment, this intense personal commitment that you have.
The thing is that I transitioned from being an alcoholic into being a workaholic, because an addict is not addicted just to one thing. It's a disease of the brain. And it's easy to move from one to another. I think this goes back to my youth and my upbringing. I was born in Ireland, into which at that time was the most Catholic conservative country in the world, in a family that was certainly the most Catholic conservative family, I would almost say, in the entire country. With extraordinarily religious as a youth, 7 o'clock mass every morning, altar boys, stations of the cross in front of my peers who would mock me. And then I lost my faith. And there was a hole there. And I had been unable to fill that hole with something.
Can I ask why? Why did you lose your faith?
You know, losing faith is something that happens. There's no reason for it. It's that as you grow a bit older and you question things in more depth, and that didn't happen until I left the country. Mm. And it's the spirituality that counts. In any religion, it's the spirituality that counts. The sense of being in touch with something greater than yourself or whatever. So what I do is that I substitute. I substitute what I do in order to find meaning. Mm. And so it's a mechanism to deal to fill that hole.
I see.
And
so there was addiction to drink. It sounds like your addiction to alcohol has been replaced by the
addiction
work.
To work.
Addiction
yes.
to work.
Yes, and just as severely. And that, of course, has affected, as did my alcoholism, all my personal relations. I hurt an awful lot of people. What you learn when you are an addict is that you have to make a differentiation between intensity and intimacy. And while I enter relationships for the intensity of the relationship, when the intensity wears off, I can't move the next step into intimacy. I have to find somebody else who can give me another dose of intensity.
Hmm.
So, and that I bring to my work. It's intensity, intensity, intensity. I get most relaxed when I go into situations of danger.
Hmm.
I relax completely because it's like the only time I ever say I have no control over anything. Anything can happen. And I accept that.
Well, let me ask you one more question that is more related to your work. And looking at the state of the world today, the Middle East, terrorism, ISIS, there are lots of reasons to be pessimistic. You've ventured into some of the worst conflicts. You've made peace. Does that make you optimistic about what's possible today?
The flip side of globalization is fragmentation. So arming yourself and turning to violence as a way to remedy your grievance is becoming an increasing problem. On the other hand, it's unlikely that we will have wars like we had in the 20th century, where we forget that, you know, at least 87 to 90 million people were killed in the 20th century, in the First World War, the Second World War, in the Stalinist era, and by Mao in China. They account for 90 million, leaving aside all the smaller conflicts. We haven't had that kind of conflict. We have made tremendous progress in the last 20 years. But there is no defense against a suicide bomber. And any person of any creed who decides to put on a suicide belt and walk out of this building and down the street and onto a subway or out anywhere at all and blow that belt, there's no defense against it. There's no way of targeting that individual beforehand. Mm. And that's, we live in a world of far greater uncertainty where the kind of terrorist attacks we saw in Paris will become more frequent. The technology to deal with these people will become more sophisticated. And you may see a wave, like in the 1970s, plane hijackings were the big thing. And then they went away. Now you have this wave of terrorist attacks of the lone wolves, so to speak,
sure,
acting on their own. And that may go away too. History has a funny way, or life has a funny way of operating in different flows.
Well, Paul Gomelli, I'm going to take heart in sort of the optimistic note that you sounded there, this idea that we forget how brutal and bloody the 20th century was. And maybe the arc of toward peace is bending in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, if we ever knew, had videos coming out of the concentration camps or death camps in Nazi Germany or Poland, we would never have had the Holocaust.
Yeah. Well, Porrig O'Malley is the John Joseph Moakley Distinguished Professor of Peace and Reconciliation at the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy Studies at UMass Boston. He's author of a number of books, most recently The Two-State Delusion, Israel and Palestine, A Tale of Two Narratives. And he's the subject of the new documentary, The Peacemaker. Porrig O'Malley, thank you so much for coming in. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, great interview. Thank you.
And to learn more about the film, The Peacemaker, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Thank you. And that's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our program is produced by a team of talented and dedicated journalists. They include Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Virginia Marshall and Adam Asher. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.